All right, welcome everybody. Welcome to Your Own Book Show. And this episode we're doing today, I'm doing from London. Maybe some of you recognize the background. My hotel room in London is legendary, I guess, by this point. I've done so many shows from the same hotel room. We'll see if in the future this hotel is getting more and more expensive. We might have to shift hotels. Great to see everybody. Alexander says, I hope you're not too jet lagged. I'm jet lagged. Maybe you can't see on the video, but I'm exhausted. It's 9:30. I'm partially doing this show just to keep myself awake so that I don't go to sleep too early and wake up too early. Anyway, we it should be interesting. I want to talk today about these sexual assault accusations against Kavanaugh and how I should think about them, or at least how I think about them. And I also want to talk about some conclusions maybe, or some issues that came out last night. Hopefully all of you watched last night. The discussion, I guess, not debate, but discussion we had with I had with Douglas Murray and Claire Fox. Claire was the moderator. I certainly enjoyed myself. I hope you guys did too. Found it a little frustrating, too short, too little time to speak, too little depth. I also thought Douglas was kind of avoiding confrontation a little bit. Maybe he didn't want to challenge me on some things where he disagreed with me. It would have been more fun, I think, if he had been more a little bit more aggressive in challenging me. But there's talk now of a round two, maybe in November. Well, not November, maybe next year, early next year, in Copenhagen. In Copenhagen. The Iran and Douglas Murray debate is indeed online. It's on the Ayn Rand Institute YouTube channel. It'll be on my YouTube channel. You can wait and watch it there. Hopefully tomorrow. Hopefully my assistant will get it up later today or early tomorrow. So it will be up soon, and you can watch it on my YouTube channel as well. I prefer you wait. So there is talk about coming to Copenhagen and doing a Douglas Murray, another discussion with Douglas Murray. Maybe we can get Fleming Rose in on the conversation as well. It should be a lot of fun. And the event last night was a lot of fun. I thought I spent more time than I expected to, really, talking about why I thought about Christianity, about religion, and about the fact that I consider Western civilization to be, in many respects, anti-Christian or anti-religious. I expected Douglas to be more combative on the issue. He wasn't. I wish he was. It would have been made it more interesting, as I said. And I want to talk about that a little bit. So I want to talk about some of what was brought up yesterday with regard to Christianity and the West. And so we'll talk about that in a little while. And then, I'll take your super chat questions. But this show today does not have to be very long, given that I'm jet lagged, I'm dying to sleep. I'm doing the show to keep myself awake. Hopefully, it'll be interesting enough to keep you guys awake. We'll see. But I am interested if you, particularly if you watched the debate last night, and not debate, the discussion last night, and you have comments, questions, use the super chat in YouTube to engage, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. The reason I want to stay awake is if I go to sleep too early, I'll wake up too early. I don't like waking up too early. So, about an hour from now would be a good time to go to sleep, and then I'll sleep into my. I'm not a morning person, so I don't like waking up early in the morning. I'm a night person, and because of jet lag, I have to recondition myself back to that. Anyway, I wanted to do the show independent of that, so I haven't done a show in a while by myself. And I want to comment on Kavanaugh. So the stuff with Kavanaugh, I find interesting and a real litmus test or an indication of the state of the culture in which we are in. And it saddens me because think about the fact that, the Kavanaugh hearings have gone on for, I don't know, a few weeks now. And there's been almost no discussion outside maybe of the hearing, but even the hearing, I don't think there was a real discussion of Kavanaugh's judicial philosophy, what he actually believes philosophically about the Constitution, about the law, about how to apply the law, about, and of course, again, I didn't follow all the hearings, even I didn't follow all the hearings, and so maybe a lot of these issues were raised, but nobody was following it, right? Nobody was interested. There were no headlines. The headlines tended to be about gotcha moments or you wrote this letter at this point, or you wrote, not issues related to the substance of what it means to be a Supreme Court judge. And what it means to be a Supreme Court judge is the interpretation of the Constitution and a particular attitude towards judicial review and whether you're an activist judge or not an activist judge. And I'm not even sure that's there's a clear distinction between the two. But what kind of activism? Was there a real discussion about his understanding of individual rights? I'm sure there wasn't a discussion of his understanding of the Declaration of Independence, and there probably was very little going over the actual Constitution to see where he stands on different issues related to the Constitution and how they apply. And again, if there was, there was very little media coverage of it. Well, a woman comes forward recently, right? And accuses Judge Kavanaugh of sexually molesting her when he was 17 and drunk, right? In a party 31 years ago, I guess. I guess he's what? He's 48. So 31 years ago, something like that. And now it's in every newspaper, it's in every report, it's in every radio show. Nobody cares about what he actually thinks. Nobody cares about what his actual philosophy is. Nobody cares about what kind of Supreme Judge, court judge he will be, although they've already categorized him. He's a conservative. But there are lots of different types of conservatives. 36 years ago, sorry, 36 years ago. So he's 50, he's 53. So he's a little closer to my age. And everybody cares. This is what they care about. They care about something that a 17-year-old did 36 years ago, more than they care about the thoughts of a potential Supreme Court judge right now, today. Now, I can understand completely if the sexual assault happened last year, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, if there was a pattern, if multiple women came forward, particularly from more recent times. But this is, as far as we know, a one-time occurrence when he was 17. And it's all over the place. It's all over the place. And it just shows the anti-intellectual nature of the culture in which we live. The anti-intellectual nature of everything that's going on in the world today. It is truly scary to me, right? Stewart says that Ted Cruz asked Kavanaugh for his favorite part of the Federalist Papers. I mean, that's good. And Ted Cruz seems to be more educated about the Constitution, more educated about the founders. And of all the candidates in the presidential election last time, Ted Cruz was the one who most tried to bring up the Constitution and the issue of individual rights, probably more than any other presidential candidate. It was terrible, primarily because of the religious issue. But at least, he has a respect for the founding document and the governing document of this country, and particularly as it relates to the Supreme Court. So we live, and maybe America's always been like this to some extent. I mean, Ayn Rand always criticized it, but I suspect it was better. I suspect there was more interest in intellectual ideas, and certainly, there was no scrutiny of judges 30, 40, 50 years ago in their personal lives, or politicians for that matter. Otherwise, none of our former presidents or and I don't know about Supreme Court judges, but certainly presidents would have been elected. And of course, there was no scrutiny of Donald Trump's personal life. And if there was, and if that were deemed important, he would have never got elected. But suddenly, we scrutinize every aspect. Now, you could say it's a man-hating culture. I don't think it's a man-hating culture. You know, if he really did commit this assault on this woman 36 years ago, then that is a bad thing. But it's 36 years ago. There's a statute of limitations. One bad thing that you did 36 years ago does not wipe out everything you have done since. And the idea that this should be taken seriously in any sense is ludicrous in my view. He didn't kill anybody. You know, he committed something that would be bad if it's true. And maybe at the time he should have been prosecuted for it. But are we going to hold every adult responsible for everything? For everything that they did when they were 17, including what they did when they were drunk when they were 17. Now, I have a view of being drunk. Don't be drunk. I mean, you know, it's a drunkenness that causes you to do these really, you know, Kavanaugh seems like, I mean, I don't agree with him on a lot of things related to the Constitution, related to law, related to his philosophy, related to religion, related to executive power. But he seems like a decent person in the sense of I don't think he's going around assaulting people. And he probably was a decent teenager, probably was pretty nerdy as a teenager. And he probably would have never assaulted the woman if he hadn't drunk. So I assuming he even did it, you know, who knows? Maybe this is all a setup. I don't expect it to be a setup, but because it's so ancient and it's so ridiculous in some respect, so I doubt that it is truly a setup. I think that it probably happened, or at least that's what the woman remembers that happened. But I don't care. I don't care. Again, if it was recent, and if there was a pattern, well, sure. Like people compare him to Moore, the judge in Alabama. Judge in Alabama, there were repeated cases of him harassing women, potentially molesting women, even when he was married, continuing through his life. It wasn't just one occurrence when he was a teenager at a party drunk. I mean, do I want to be measured by what I did when I was 16 and 17? No, even though I don't think I did anything nearly as bad as this. Still, you know, it's not how we should, you know, it's not how... It's not how we should evaluate talent. It's not how we should evaluate somebody for a job. I don't think you would do it in a company. Again, 36 years later, 5 years later, absolutely. 10 years later, maybe. 36 years later, no. No, you don't dig 36 years back into a person's history. It's not interesting. It doesn't reflect who they are today. So, you know, it looks like on Monday we'll get both Kavanaugh and this woman's testimony in front of the Senate panel. Both seem to have agreed to testify. But, no, I'm sorry. I think it is. It's not hard to ignore if it was decades ago. The law ignores these things all the time. There's such a thing as what do you call it? I said it a second ago, right? The term that relates to this. You know, some things you don't prosecute. After a certain period of time, you can't prosecute. And there's a reason for that. One of the reasons is that you can't be objective about it. You can't actually know what happened 36 years ago. I don't remember what happened 36 years ago. Any woman can say anything she wants about a party 36 years ago. I barely remember what I did yesterday. You think I remember what I did 36 years ago? No, I'm pretty sure I never assaulted anybody 36 years ago. But I can't defend myself. I don't know. I couldn't tell you who else was in the party. I couldn't tell you what I drank, if I drank at all. I couldn't tell you who I danced with. I couldn't tell you anything about the party from 36 years ago. Anything I did 36 years ago. Well, a few things. I think I got married 36 years ago, so I can probably tell you that a little bit. But even the wedding, can I tell you who was there? I don't remember who was there. Statue of Limitations. Thank you, Amy. That's why I need Amy on the show. We need young blood on the show to remind me of the things that I forget. There's a Statue of Limitations because of the impossibility of objectivity that far back, the impossibility of witnesses to remember what happened that far back. It's hard enough for witnesses to be objective about what they saw yesterday, never mind about what they saw 36 years ago. So if you cannot have an objective standard for actually discovering the truth, then what are we supposed to do? It's going to be a he said, she said. And then we're going to say, oh, well, I believe her more than him, or I believe him more than her. And none of it has any cognitive meaning, any cognitive standing, because none of it's objective. None of it's objective. And you don't try people based on non-objective standards. And you don't accept, you don't condemn a man who, again, by all indications, has led an exemplary life since then, as far as we know, based on allegations that cannot be proved, cannot be evaluated objectively because it's 36 years late. So statute of limitations should apply. And I believe that Kavanaugh should go on stage and say, you shouldn't care. And I think Congress, senators should say, Kavanaugh should say, I can't prosecute this. I can't prove I'm innocent. I can't disprove her because it's 36 years ago. Leave me alone. Now, I don't know if it's normal for a 17-year-old to, in a sense, molest a 15-year-old. I mean, yeah, when we were 17, we did some stupid things. We probably touched women in ways that are inappropriate, and we should have been slapped down. If it was really as bad as this woman is claiming, then she should have filed charges at the time. We do stupid things as kids, trying to figure out what it means to be man, what it means to be a woman, what are the differences between men and women. All of that is part of what we do as we're growing up. Again, I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying it's what happens. But that is irrelevant in the sense that, again, if it was 5 years ago, it would be relevant, but it's not. Now, it's true. Shane says Kavanaugh should not say he shouldn't care because that would be suicide. Yeah, it would be suicide because we live in a crazy, insane, infantile, concrete-bound, anti-intellectual world. I mean, Donald Trump is tweeting that she's lying. How does he know she's lying? How does anybody know she's lying? Maybe she's telling the truth. I don't know. Nobody knows, and nobody will know. After this, we won't know. We still don't know if Anita Hill was lying. And that was a recent event. That wasn't way back in the past. This is why you have courts of law. This is why if somebody molests you, go to the police immediately and have him prosecuted. Don't wait 36 years to bring it up when he's being nominated for an important position. Anyway, I did my thing on Me Too. I'm very sympathetic, as I said, to much of the Me Too movement. I'm very non-sympathetic to men molesting women. I'm very sympathetic to the women coming out and saying no more and bringing people like Harvey Weinstein down and many of these others. I'm very, very, very sympathetic to all of that. And again, if Kavanaugh had shown any kind of inclination that he was that kind of person, I'd say you have to vote against him. But as far as I know, and we'll see what happens, and maybe this is her attempt to get other women to come out. But as far as I know, as far as we know to this day, this is one accusation about one event when he was a kid. You don't evaluate a man in his 50s based on what he did when he was 17. That would be absurd. That would be absurd. It's part of growing up is we do stupid things. All right. Moses Saliva asks, How should we treat false accusations legally? Well, you can prosecute false accusations. I mean, certainly if she testifies under oath and she falsely accuses him under oath, then she's in contempt of court, contempt of Congress, and that is a prosecutable offense. Falsely accusing somebody and publicly, I don't know, but it seems like that would fall under defamation or libel or something. Maybe one of the lawyers can tell us. You can't defame somebody. You can't say you did this and this to me when you didn't. There are laws in the books today. There are procedures in court that allow you to seek remedy when somebody does that to you. That doesn't concern me. If she is falsely accusing, now, again, how do you prove that she's falsely accusing? Part of the problem is that we'll never know. We'll never know. I mean, she at some point demanded the FBI investigate this. How can the FBI investigate a 36-year-old crime? A 36-year-old crime that happened at a party 36 years ago. There's no physical evidence anymore. The witnesses, again, I don't remember what I did and what I saw 36 years ago. So, yeah, there is no investigation. All right, if you have any questions on that, if you have anything you want to say on it, then you've got the Super Chat feature. You can make a comment, I'll read it, or you can ask a question, I'll do it. But if there's nothing more on this topic, I'm going to shift topics. All right. Brandon asks, this is a good question. Should people be critical of Google for cooperating with the totalitarian China in creating a censored search engine? I mean, I'll quibble. I don't think China's totalitarian. It's authoritarian, but I don't think it's totalitarian. And there's a difference. Authoritarian means a government, a ruling system that has the authority to do anything it wants, really, to control anything. But totalitarian means it's actually implements that control, every aspect of life, that it's totalitarian means total control of everything. And I just don't think that's China. And I've been to China several times. I've spoken in China. I've been allowed to speak on capitalism and criticize Mao and criticize the Chinese regime, Chinese system of government. That would not be tolerated in a totalitarian regime. Now I'm not trying to whitewash anything. They are authoritarian and they can be brutal and they suppress free speech and they go after certain people, not as consistently as totalitarian regimes do. And there's a lot of opposition within China that are free, that are not in jail. But granted that, change totalitarian to authoritarian, should people be critical of Google for cooperating with authoritarian China and creating a censored search engine? Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's horrible to see American high-tech companies cooperating with the Chinese government on ways to restrict the freedom of their own citizens. And this has been ongoing because Microsoft has been doing it. American companies have sold the Chinese facial recognition technology, which is being used which was explicitly, the purpose of which was to be used to spy on Chinese citizens. American companies have given the Chinese government and the American government, by the way, back keys into servers so the equivalent of the NSA in China and the NSA in the United States can spy on us and read our emails and figure out what we do. So to the extent that tech companies are cooperating with Chinese government or the American government for that, in that case, they should be condemned. I think it's horrible. I think it's a sanction of the victim. It'll turn out it's a China that is not free, a China that is more and more and more authoritarian, a China that might one day become totalitarian, and they are using technologies in ways that are going to make them totalitarian, is not good for Google. Google won't survive in such a world. Google will not get money in such a world. Google would be wiped out. So that is not a good world to strive towards. It's not a good world. It's not the kind of world American business should be helping create. I saw a story about this new initiative in China. This is the move towards totalitarianism. I don't think they're quite there, but a move towards. The Chinese want to initiate something called a social scoring system, where they give a score to every Chinese citizen based on how good they are to society. And to do this, they are using CCTVs everywhere. They're trying to plaster China with CCTVs so they can monitor you, facial recognition, so they can identify you no matter where you are and track you. And they're really starting to institute Big Brother in the full manifestation, a real totalitarian state. And they're going to track you. You know, the next step is, and I saw an article about this. I haven't read it yet. I'm going to read it and let you know about it. But an article where governments around the world are interested now in chips that you will be able to implant into babies when they're born, and be able to track them from when they're born. You know, they'll do it in the name of, well, we want to make sure they exercise, or, well, we want to make sure we want to monitor their heart rate and all this other stuff so we can provide better healthcare services, particularly in socialized medicine. You can expect that this will become a dominant request is to put a chip inside of you so that the government can monitor your health, so that they can allocate medical resources more efficiently. That'll be the excuse. But think about it. They've got cameras everywhere. They've got a chip in you, which maybe has a GPS. They've got facial recognition on the cameras. They will know everything about us. They'll know, you know, they'll know literally everything, everything physical about us, everything physical that we're doing. They can't quite read our minds, but they're probably working on that too. That is real Big Brother. That is totalitarianism. In the kind of totalitarianism that 1984 envisions, a kind of authoritarianism, the totalitarianism that is far worse than anything that the communist could ever do, because they didn't have the technology for it. And that's the hope. The hope is that as it becomes more and more authoritarian, the technology collapses, that they can't sustain the technology, because technology to invent, and I think to some extent to sustain, requires freedom. And as freedom collapses, the technology will collapse with it, and the authoritarianism will collapse with that. But it's going to be ugly in the meantime. And it takes a long time for everything to collapse. And for American companies to help that, that is terrible. That is terrible. Luke asks, given that you said how bad Google is in collaborating with the Chinese in limited searches, should the U.S. government intervene in some way? No. No, not unless the U.S. government deems China an enemy state. And again, I believe the U.S. government should have categories. Friends, you know, people that we're not happy with, but not friends, but are not enemies. I think China falls in that category for the most part. And then a third category of enemies. And the category of enemies you do not trade with, you do not supply technology with. Google wouldn't be able to do contracts with China if we define China as an enemy. Now, granted, in the world we live in today, we don't define anybody as an enemy. I mean, Donald Trump is best friends now with the genocidal murderer of North Korea. So we have no enemies, right? So I can't expect the current foreign policy, establishment to define that. But if we had a list of enemies, Iran, North Korea, then you would say, you can't trade with them. Embargo, not tariffs, embargo them. And then Google couldn't do it. I don't think it's the job of the government to police Google. I think it's the job of shareholders. I would hope some shareholders would sponsor a shareholder amendment urging Google, in the name of the owners of the company, not to cooperate with the Chinese in this way. It's not in shareholders' interests. Long-term, it'll hurt Google, and therefore long-term, it'll hurt them. So, again, I don't think China's totalitarian. I think they might become totalitarian, but I don't think they are. They're authoritarian, and they are. I don't think it's wrong to engage with them economically at this point. Now, as they get worse, which they are getting worse, and they approach becoming more totalitarian and more authoritarian, then yeah, I think you'd have to reconsider whether we should deal with China or not, or whether we should buy Chinese products or not. But I still think if you look at the scope of history and you look at what China is today, China's so much freer than it used to be. The Chinese people are so much freer than they've ever been, probably for 100 years, and even more free than they were probably under the emperors. So, yeah, I don't see China as so bad as not to trade with them. Although things get worse in China, they could become that. Now, remember, this is the same day, right? We're complaining about Google and China, that Donald Trump sold weapons, sophisticated, high-tech weapons to Saudi Arabia and announced it with pride. And Saudi Arabia is an enemy, right? I don't know. You guys, I know, love, some of you love Donald Trump. What's he selling weapons to Saudis? The Saudis. The funders of Al-Qaeda, the funders of ISIS, or at least in its initial phases. Really? We're selling them weapons? Wahhabis are controlling American weapons. They have been for decades. But Donald Trump, the tough guy, is proud of that? Really is sad to see that there is no foreign policy. The United States has no foreign policy. All right, a follow-up question on China. China threatened Trump yesterday about tariffs. Well, they've said they'll raise tariffs on 60 billion of American goods. They can't match the 200 billion because they don't import enough to put tariffs. So Trump shot us in the knees. He shot us in the foot before. Now he's shooting us in the knees. The Chinese are going to shoot themselves in the knees as well. And we'll pretend that this is a trade war. Do you think we will see war anytime soon? I assume by war you mean real war, missiles and bombs and guns and soldiers. No, I don't think we'll see war. I don't know if when you'll see war again between nuclear-powered countries like China and the United States. I doubt that it's going to happen anytime soon. Too much to lose. Both parties have too much to lose. What do you call it? Both parties have nukes. Any kind of war could easily deteriorate it into a nuclear confrontation. Chinese certainly don't want that. I don't think Donald Trump wants that. No, so I don't see a war. I think China and the United States will push each other, will nudge each other, but I don't see it coming to actual physical confrontation. I don't think the Chinese want it. The Chinese would lose. They'd lose big time. The United States would whip them in open warfare. So they're much smarter to learn from the Islamists. Just chip away at the US. You just take a little bit here and take a little bit there, and you chip away. And so on. I haven't missed your question. Can't think of a name. I will get to it. It's just that these questions all have a common theme, so I don't want to jump back and forth. We're already in a trade war of sorts. It's nowhere near as bad as the trade war of the 1930s, of the early 1930s, which led us into a Great Depression, but it's still stupid and bad, and Americans are gonna pay for this, and Chinese are gonna pay for this. Hardworking Americans, hardworking Chinese businesses and individuals are going to be, are going to pay for this, and are going to suffer as a consequence of this. And there's no reason for it. There's zero reason for this. So, it's unbelievably self-destructive. It's unbelievably suicidal, it's not suicidal because we're not going to actually die, but it's self-destructive. Why? What for? Because he made a campaign promise. Because he's advised by people who know nothing about economics. Yeah, so tariffs are stupid. If you're going to do something because somebody's an enemy, then you embargo them, but you do not put tariffs. Tariffs never, ever, 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 ever. Makes sense. There's never an excuse for them. Okay, can't think of a name. Asks, what is the objectivist rationale on abortion? Actually, I'd recommend that you go back to a show I did last week with Larry Salzman. I thought Larry did a good job explaining the objectivist rationale on abortion. Basically, objectivism is pro-abortion. Yeah, I said pro-abortion, not pro. You know, we believe abortion is a good thing. Wow, I said it. It makes it possible for a woman to decide and to decide whether to have a baby or not. It gives her an option of how she's going to live her life. And that's a good thing. That's a moral thing. That is the so from an objectivist perspective, the essence of morality is making choices about your life, that rational choices about your life that will make your life the best life that it can be over the long run, over a lifetime. Morality is about being rational about those choices. And whenever you can create a political situation, and politics is about leaving you alone to make those choices. It's about protecting your ability to make those choices better than leaving you alone. It's about protecting your ability to make those choices by protecting you from the one thing that limits choices, which is force. Which is force, right? So the only job of God is to protect individual rights. A woman has a right to make a decision about her own body, about her own future, about her own destiny, about the long-term consequences of her life. And as a consequence, she has complete authority, complete moral sanction, and complete legal authority to make rational decisions about how her body is going to be used, about how, and about her future, about whether she wants a baby or not. And the fact, the beauty of abortion, the beauty of the technology of abortion, is that now she has the ability, even if she makes a mistake by getting pregnant, she has the ability to reverse that. And at a pretty minimal cost if she does it early enough. It becomes more and more expensive in a variety of different ways, expensive throughout the pregnancy. But certainly early, it's a relatively easy procedure. It's cheap, it's quick, and it's harmless. So the only concern that the law has here, and that morality really has here, is about the decision-making of, coerce a particular decision over another decision, So, the woman's right to an abortion in that sense is, in my view, absolute. Now, people say, but what about later? What about when it has a heartbeat? And I covered this with Larry Salzman, and I thought he gave a great explanation of this. But the essential here is a fetus does not have rights. We're not born with some innate thing that is rights. Rights are protections, the protection of human beings. The protections of our lives, that again, that protect our ability to make choices, to live our lives free of coercion. There is no entity making choices here other than the woman. There's no entity fully living as a human being other than the woman. Now, once a baby is born, then it gains the protection of the state, it gains the protection of individual rights. But until it's born, it doesn't have those protections. It's the mother that has those protections because she is the only thinking, living, acting entity that's independent, individual, making decisions. Now, it's true when the baby's born, it can't think and it can't make decisions for itself. But it is now an individuated human being. It is now, the decision has been made to give birth and therefore to bring this human being into existence. But note that even at that point, rights are limited, right? It's not that the baby now has a complete set of rights to do and say, and, you know, children don't have that, whatever they want. Well, you know, they can't walk into the street. Their rights, in a sense, are delegated to their parents. So rights are contextual. Rights are in the context of morality. Rights come into being in a context of morality. To be a moral functioning being is the adult, is the mother. And therefore, her rights are the ones that must be protected. Now, we could go on and on about this. And again, I encourage you to go listen to my conversation with Larry Salzman, which was excellent in many respects, but I thought he gave a really good good issue with abortion. Brandon asks, so we're going to continue on the abortion thing. Why should abortion be allowed after viability? Again, because there's no fully functional, there's no context for granting the viable fetus rights. The woman has the rights. If a woman is indecisive for that long of a time, shouldn't we protect the unborn child, provided the birth will not harm her or the baby? No. For first, there are very few abortions, very, very, very few abortions that are done after viability. Almost all the abortions that are done after viability are abortions that have to do with either the risk to the mother's life or a birth defect, a serious birth defect in the fetus. So this idea that the debate on abortion is about last trimester is just not true. It's a red herring, right? And doctors won't do it. It's not a pleasant procedure. Women don't want to do it. But again, the state, the law, has no business here. Now, it's quite possible to say that a woman who waits until then is being immoral. I'm open to saying that because it increases the risk. It's a bit of whim worship. It's probably not rational. If they didn't want the baby, she should have done it first trimester. But, you know, as long as the baby's not born, as long as the baby as long as the fetus is inside the mother, it is part of her body, and the decision is fully and wholly hers, and whether the fetus lives or does not. We don't believe in natural rights, that you have natural rights when you're viable. As soon as you're viable, boom, God puts natural rights into you. No, rights in the context of, it's the application of morality within a social context. It's to protect acting human beings, acting in reality. A fetus is not acting in reality. Fetus is inside the mother. He's not an acting, individuated being. And as such, has no rights. And therefore, the state should not be protecting. Again, it might be immoral for the mother to do it, but the state has no business in this. Asterisk asks, what are your thoughts on people who say insurance in general is a scam? What do you think about insurance companies? I love insurance companies. I don't think insurance is a scam at all. I think insurance is wonderful. I use insurance all the time. I have car insurance. I have health insurance. I have life insurance. I don't understand the argument that it's a scam. I know people who say this. I know Austrian economists who claim, it's a collectivistic thing and it's shifting the risk. But it's consensual. It makes logical sense if you understand the math. It makes complete logical sense to buy insurance, to pay a small amount now, and everybody agrees to it. And insurance is rated, you're rated based on the risk that you present. It's a contract. It's not forced on you. I don't consider Social Security insurance. I don't consider Medicare insurance. I'm talking about a real insurance policy that's gained voluntarily through a process. I love insurance. Again, I think insurance makes it possible for us to do risky activities, which is sometimes necessary for advancing in life. I think insurance protects us from suffering from a real bad disease. I mean, there's no way for us to self-insure, particularly when we're younger. And why not pool resources? We pool resources to create companies called corporations. We pool resources to provide debt. It's called a bank. We pool resources in lots of different financial transactions. And insurance companies is just another type of financial transaction that involves pooling resources. Right? So, yeah, I don't understand at all, the issue with why insurance would be in any way, form, or shape a bad thing. I mean, again, you have to be smart about what insurance you buy. Certain insurance policies, I think, are bad. You shouldn't buy universal health, universal life insurance. It doesn't make any sense. You should buy term life insurance and then save money separately in a diversified portfolio.
People asking, you should ask in a super chat chain, not just free write off of other people's super chat. But yeah, if somebody shoots a pregnant woman and kills both her and the fetus, or just the fetus, is he to blame for the murder of two lives? Yeah, because the mother has chosen to carry the fetus. As long as the mother chooses to carry the fetus, it is hers. Now, is it for murder? No, but it is. You're harming the mother and the baby that she has chosen to have. An abortion is she chooses not to have it. So you're violating the mother's rights. It's not that you violated the fetus rights. You violated the mother's rights, but doubly, in that you not only took, you shot her and you destroyed her kidney, but not only did you destroy a kidney, but you destroyed the fetus that she intended to carry through life. All right. I think I got all the Super Chat questions. Did I miss anybody? I'm just going back and checking. I think I got them. Okay, you can keep them coming if you want. Keep it coming if you want. I mean, I want to make a comment about something that was said yesterday during the discussion about Western civilization. I thought it was a good discussion, and I thought it brought out some of the differences between me and Douglas Murray. I was a little disappointed we didn't go deeper into some of the issues. Certainly, the issue of immigration, there was a lot more that could have been discussed, and it wasn't really discussed. And partially because I do think the context of Europe is very different than the context of America. I think that the issue of Islamic immigration is very different than the issue of immigration more generally, given that we're at war with with a certain part of the Islamic world. So I think there are a lot of issues that we could have covered and didn't get to. It was way too short. I found it frustrating. But I think I said at the beginning of the show, there is talk about a part two where we will have an opportunity to delve deeper in some of these issues. I did want to, at some point, Douglas Murray said, you cannot separate Western civilization from Christianity. It would be something completely different if not for Christianity. And there's a certain truth to that. Although I think it would be different in that it would be better. And to the extent that I consider Western civilization the best culture, the best civilization ever, if anything, Christianity holds that civilization back and prevents it from full manifestation of its destiny. Indeed, I think one of the reasons that Western civilization is in decline and has been in decline for at least 100 years is because it never expulged Christianity from within it, that it has never rejected Christianity and religion more broadly completely from it. Even in Europe, Christianity was given morality. So they took away the mysticism, and they took away the mysticism primarily, but they kept the Christian morality. The Christian morality has never been challenged. The Christian morality has never been, rejected by Western civilization. And until it does, Western civilization will struggle. What is holding back Western civilization is altruism. And the strongest, most powerful, most virulent form of altruism is religious altruism, even when it's held in secular societies. So the Christian form of altruism, which I think is the worst, you know, the idea of suffering for sins you didn't commit, the idea of dying for the sake of others, the idea of self-sacrifice as a virtue, the idea of the sanctity of the life of Mother Teresa and the evil of the life of Bill Gates, that kind of Christianity has to die out for Western civilization to thrive and be successful and to prosper and to do well. And as a consequence, of course, Islam has to die out from within Western civilization, and Judaism, you know, I think is a very weak force within Western civilization, so I'm not sure it has that much impact, but certainly Christianity does. But imagine the arts. We talked a lot about the power of arts and the significance of art as helping bring meaning. Imagine the art of Western civilization without Christianity. I mean, wow. Imagine if Michelangelo just made sculptures like the David and wasn't handcuffed spiritually and physically by a pope, but certainly spiritually by Christianity and the need to go on and on about the fatal state of man and original sin and we're all going to hell and the just this weight of Christianity, of guilt, of oppression on his shoulders. What kind of sculpture, what kind of art would we have today? Imagine if the art of the post-Renaissance had all been secular rather than all religious themed. I mean, wow. Wow. Ayn Rand, I think, gave Christianity maybe too much credit for the idea of individualism, for the idea of an individual relationship between man and God, and that was a precursor for individualism. I mean, maybe that's true. I'm not sure how important that is. She also, you know, there's also some claim about Christianity about separation of church and state, to Caesar unto Caesar, to God unto God. Jesus at some point didn't stop the Catholic Church from being involved in politics for most of its life until the Enlightenment, when finally we got a separation of church and state. And we got a separation of church and state not because of that passage in the New Testament. We got a separation of church and state because of the Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment realized the danger, the evil of having church and state combined. Again, it was the secular that gave us the positive values, not the religion. So there is very little value in the post-Renaissance era, in the post-discovery of Greek philosophy era, for religion. And if not for the massive political power religion had during those years, if not for the way the church persecuted people, if they expressed unreligious or non-religious beliefs, then maybe religion would have been annihilated much earlier. Maybe the Enlightenment would have been better grounded in secular, in reality, in secular beliefs, rather than latching on to the remnants of Christianity. Because the fact is, you know, John Locke and people like that, you know, they were religious, but it's hard to tell, right? Because what were the risk were they facing by announcing to the world that they didn't believe in God? Well, death, even in the 18th century. I mean, Locke had to escape England because he was afraid of, I think it was a Catholic king, came to rule for a few years, and he was afraid of being persecuted by the Catholic king, so he had to run. Voltaire, an explicit atheist, a French Enlightenment figure, had to escape Paris, I think for Amsterdam, in order to escape religious persecution. And that's in the 18th century. Anything before the 18th century, you were just burned at the stake. You were just killed. You were slaughtered. So secular Enlightenment thinking was dramatically slowed by the immense political power that the church had pre the founding of America. So what exactly values did Christianity add to Western civilization, to the values we associate with Western civilization, reason, individualism, science, technology, business, capitalism? None of those have anything to do with Christianity. Somebody says here that my teacher said Voltaire killed atheists. No, Voltaire was an atheist. Voltaire was an atheist. Go back and study history. He went to Geneva. Somebody said he went to Geneva. I've for years have said he went to Amsterdam, but I've been told now a couple of times that that's a mistake. You're right. He went to Geneva in Switzerland, which was more secular, and where the religious authorities could not get him. But yeah, it's religion that hampered the West. It's religion that slowed down the progress of the Enlightenment. And it's the fact that religion had political power, I think, prevented Enlightenment thinkers from having the freedom to think completely outside of the box and to completely challenge the pervading morality, which they never did until Ayn Rand. And I said at the end of the talk yesterday that Ayn Rand completes the assignment or completes the work that was the Enlightenment, the intellectual work that was the Enlightenment. I think she, I mean, I it's not finished. There's lots of work still to do. But she answers all the most fundamental questions that the Enlightenment leaves unanswered. She answers where does morality come from. She provides a secular morality to go with the secularized politics. She defines properly what individual rights are and where individual rights come from and why individual rights are necessary. John Locke, while he introduced the idea of individual rights, he never really couldn't really defend them. He couldn't really ground them in reality because he had to ground them in some conception of God. She explains, importantly, the epistemology, you know, the efficacy of reason. So they aren't understood the importance of reason. Reasons as a means of knowledge and scientific method and so on. But they didn't have a full understanding of reason. Again, they were still too dependent on mysticism, and they didn't have the right epistemology. And here comes Ayn Rand and actually presents us with a good, proper epistemology, which is, you know, astounding. The amount of breakthrough work that Ayn Rand did is just stunning. And in that sense, she really does complete the work started with the Enlightenment. She does indeed provide with many answers from metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, individual rights, and politics that the Enlightenment started. She explains why force is evil, fully explains why force is evil and why, therefore, government should be constrained and why government should only be a protector of individual rights. All of that Ayn Rand does in a way that nobody before her, in a way that nobody before her did. All right, I think that's about an hour. That's good for today. So unless there are any Super Chat questions, I'm going to wrap it in. I will say that I did an interview today for a podcast by, you know, one of the leading intellectuals in the UK, certainly a leading intellectual on the right in the UK, James... and I don't want to slaughter the name, and my software is messing me up here. All right, here it is. Sorry, guys. Still not working. Anyway, James Dellingpole, who is, very, very influential thinker, writer, intellectual on the so-called right. He's actually, and I didn't even realize this, he's actually affiliated with Breitbart. So he's much more pro-Trump than I am. We had a little bit of a conversation about Trump. But he came to my hotel and we taped a podcast. And when the podcast goes up, I'll let you know. We've also talked about doing an event in the future. He is this is great. This is the kind of people that I need to interact with, that I want to interact with and impress on them the importance of Ayn Rand. He's written negatively, very negatively on Ayn Rand, I think in 2010, a little bit more positively in 2012. And I think after being with me, I think he's likely to be a lot more positive about Ayn Rand. I think there's a very high likelihood that you know, this is going to be positive. So this isn't a series. So we did Douglas Murray yesterday. We did James Dellingpole today. On October 13th, I am doing an event with Dave Rubin and Weinstein. If you live in New York, you can look it up online. You can find the Institute of Weinstein, Dave Rubin, and it will come up. James Dellingpole, you know, made a name for himself as a big enemy of global warming, and you know, of the scaremongering around global warming. But if you look him up, he's very, very well known. And then let's see, we've got Douglas Murray, James Dellingpole, Eric Weinstein, and then I will return to London in November to have another conversation with Brandon O'Neill, another very, very influential British intellectual. I have more access to intellectuals here in the UK than I do in the US. They're also, dare I say, cheaper than they are in the US, where to get Ben Shapiro to come to an event is $30,000-$40,000. But hopefully in December, I'll be sitting down with Ben Shapiro as well. So it's gonna be a good fall. It's gonna be a good fall. So you know, we're hitting, you know, ready, sat down and met Jordan Peterson. Now we're doing Douglas Murray, James Dellingpole, Eric Weinstein, Brandon O'Neill, and of course, Ben Shapiro. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have covered all of those. Hopefully that'll generate some significant increase in my subscriptions on YouTube. So those of you out there, please remember to subscribe on my YouTube channel. Please remember to you know, add your support to the show by going to Patreon and making a contribution. All right, Brandon has one more question. Why aren't rights natural? Not from God or the supernatural, but from the absence of force, fraud, and coercion. Yes, rights are not from the absence of force, fraud, and rights are the recognition that man must use his cognition, his reason, in order to survive and thrive in reality. And as a consequence, when he is in a social context, when he's with other people, then he must be protected from force, fraud, and coercion. And that is what rights serve. Rights serve the purpose of recognizing that force is the enemy of reason. And that reason is man's means of survival, basic means of survival. And that rights are the means by which we protect reason. It's the means by which we protect the human mind. It's it's the way in which we protect the ability of man to be moral. We protect his ability to make choices, to be rational, to use his mind. So rights are not part of our nature in the sense that we're born with them. It's in the DNA. They're not given to us by God. They're not imprinted in us through evolution. They're a consequence of the kind of being we are. They're a consequence of the fact that we are a rational being. They're a consequence of the fact that reason is our basic means of survival and that force is the enemy of reason. That is what rights are. They're the recognition of that, and they're the subordination of laws, the subordination of government, of man to the laws of morality, to the idea that you cannot use force on other people because by doing so, you're destroying their capacity to take care of themselves, and therefore you're destroying their capacity to act on their own behalf, to be moral. All right? So they're natural in a sense that they're not supernatural. They're natural in the sense that they come from the nature of man, but they're not natural in the sense that they're part of us. They're not an intrinsic feature, and therefore a fetus just doesn't have them. And it's not like when they're born, whoop, something is thrown at them by nature, by God. It's that once they're born, they become individuals. They become actors within a social context. They become beings which must be left free to use their mind to pursue their values. All right. All right, thanks, everybody. And I'll probably do a show tomorrow. I like doing these shows from London, and you seem to like them. There have been quite a few people online, live, so that it should be fun. So think about any questions you might have, any issues you might want to raise before the show tomorrow, and send me those questions if you want. You can send them uronbrookshow.com, or prepare to spend a little money on the Super Chat, and I'll prepare some commentary on some things that are maybe going on in the world, going on in the news, going on in Europe, going on here. And the Europeans are having a blast because this is a good time for them. It's like evening. It's already late, so it's after dinner, and they can actually sit, relax, and enjoy the Iran Book Show. So again, I remind you, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. Encourage your friends to subscribe. Share, share, share. And when you share, also encourage them to subscribe. And go to Patreon and support the show. Patreon.com, Iran Book Show, /Iran Book Show. All right. Thanks, everybody. I need to remember how to end this video. Yeah, I know how to do it. And I will see you all.